Good morning. The first case of the morning will be James Minch versus City of Chicago. Mr. Carnuth.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Michael Carnuth, and I'm here on behalf of two former high-ranking officers in the City of Chicago's Fire Department and the class of other firefighters who they represent, who were mandatorily retired without due process and in contravention of the property rights afforded them under their collective bargaining agreement. Plaintiffs appealed the decision of Judge Duryagin dismissing their case on the grounds that they had no property interest in their jobs. That decision is erroneous because the collective bargaining agreement at issue in this case is a binding contract that contains three provisions guaranteeing that plaintiffs had a property right to continued employment without the threat of age-based termination. The first of the three provisions in the contract securing that right is the just cause provision contained in Section 16.2.
Let's talk about Article 16 for just a moment, because you read Article 16 to prohibit any form of involuntary termination, including mandatory retirement, except for just cause.
Correct,
right?
Your Honor.
But Article 16 speaks in terms of discharge. And do we normally think of mandatory retirement as a discharge?
Yes, Your Honor. As we indicate in our brief, in our reply brief, the definition of involuntary retirement contains the term discharge. It's a discharge does fit within the Section 16.2 definition of just cause.
But, you know, someone who retires voluntarily or involuntarily leaves her employment with retirement benefits, and that would put her in a different situation than the usual person who is fired, wouldn't it?
Well, if the person retires voluntarily, then there's no problem with that person leaving the employment. There's no dispute that they had a right to leave because they did it voluntarily. In this instance, the contract that is at issue here prevents the city from involuntarily discharging somebody without just cause. And just cause has to mean something that indicates that the person is unable to do their job. An arbitrary age does not indicate that they are not able to do their job.
Now, let's go to Section 9.1C, which seems to recognize several different types of involuntary terminations in addition to a discharge for cause, including layoffs, terminations for failure to report to work, you know, so forth and so on. Wouldn't that language suggest that the city could involuntarily terminate a firefighter for reasons other than just cause?
Well, Your Honor, the section that you're referring to is the seniority rights provision in the collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
And that provision only addresses the rights that somebody accrues while they're a member of the fire department. It's a term that addresses when seniority ends and that it no longer accrues, that seniority no longer accrues when someone is retired. It doesn't mention...
But see, what I'm trying to get at is, doesn't that put to rest any notion that a discharge for cause is the only means of terminating an employee's service without his consent? A termination for failure to report to work, for example, is recognized as a termination that would be distinct from discharge for cause.
Well, Your Honor, that example, which is identified in Section 9.1C4, is an example of a for-cause termination. If a person doesn't show up to work when they're supposed to, that's grounds for dismissal. The situation we have here has no basis. If the just cause provision is to have any relevance, it must measure a person's capability of doing the job. An arbitrary, broad-based termination does not measure the person's capability of doing their job or their fitness to do the job. And that's why the just cause provision has to have meaning. There's plenty of court decisions that rule that the just cause provisions in collective bargaining agreements are do establish a property right in continued employment. And this collective bargaining agreement does just that.
Now, it seems to me there's an issue here that isn't getting very much attention. What seems to me is an important issue, and that is the law of the case. This case was decided originally by Judge Bucklow on coming out with a different result, and the judge from whom the appeal is taken here, I think, dismissed that on grounds that I think are there's at least apparently questionable. And you've only discussed it in a footnote to your reply brief, so I don't know whether you've adequately raised the issue or not, but I think the law of the case is a pretty important principle, and I'm not sure why it isn't being followed here. Why do we have two decisions here in the same case?
Your Honor, we do agree with you that Judge Duryagin should have adhered to the decision that was rendered by Judge Bucklow.
Well, where do we go from there? I mean, what does that dictate as the appropriate result here?
Well, as this court did in the case that we cited to in Williams versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue, the court indicated that if there's no new law, no new facts, and the decision by the prior judge is solid, then it should be adhered to. And Judge Duryagin didn't point to any improper reasoning or any new law or facts that would change.
The problem, forgive me for interrupting, Mr. Carnuth, but the problem, and I have the same a query basically as Judge Cudahy does, is that you did not pursue the argument in your opening brief. And, you know, our case law basically would say that the court isn't even obliged to discuss the issue at this point. His rationale for reopening the briefing wasn't accurate, but we have, you know, how do we deal with this problem now?
Your Honor, I acknowledge that we did not use the term law of the case as a basis, but we did acknowledge, we did argue in our opening brief that that Judge Duryagin should have followed the decision by Judge Bucklow, and that it was a decision that stood, that should have been applied going forward. I mean, we were all shocked when we went before Judge Duryagin with a case management plan at the time, when he said that he wanted the city to sua sponte refile their motion to dismiss. And when that happened, I think the city was shocked as well, because they didn't have any inclination that the judge would want to revisit what Judge Bucklow already ruled upon.
Well, could you have taken an appeal at that point?
An appeal of his... Of his ruling to revisit Judge Bucklow's decision?
Well, asking for a motion to dismiss.
Your Honor, I haven't looked into that issue. I would assume that we would have the right to appeal any final order that Judge Duryagin entered. I see that my time is up, and I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Enriquez.
May it please the court, the city defends the dismissal of plaintiff's federal due process claim on two grounds. Plaintiffs brought the claim prematurely, and the claim fails on the merits.
you know, when we talk about the procedural due process claim being premature, we've got kind of the same problem that your adversaries have, because that was an argument you made solely in a footnote below, wasn't it?
Yes, it is, although we're the appellee, and this court may affirm on any ground supported by the record. They're the appellant. They waived the claim, and the court, that is a waiver that which should stand.
So it's your view that your argument that was made solely in a footnote is not waiver of that argument?
It's not waiver. Well, it may be waiver, but the law is that the appellate court may, in fact, resolve the claim. Now,
that principle only applies, though, if the issue has been raised in the district court, doesn't it?
Excuse me?
The issue has to be raised in the district court in order to take advantage of affirming it on any ground.
Actually not. I think the law, including Supreme Court authority, is that even if a claim, even if an argument is not raised in the district court, this court may affirm.
You got any
affirm.
Case that says that?
Yes, the cases that we cite in our brief, there's a case that involves Daly, I think it's, the Rothner case of this court. We cite these cases, and they cite Supreme Court authority as well. Today we'll rest on our brief for the position that the plaintiffs brought this claim prematurely.
I'd like to hear something about why you don't have a law of the case problem.
Well, it isn't a law of the case problem. It may be that Judge Yerhagen should have. There's an argument, of course, that he could have followed Judge Bucklow's decision. But whatever happened in the district court, the case is now before this court, and if the ultimate decision on the merits in the district court is wrong, this court may reverse. This court is certainly not bound to accept.
No, I think we're not bound necessarily, but and Judge Bucklow may well be wrong, but we're kind of in a procedural muddle because you're not appealing from her decision here.
No, we're not appealing from any decision.
The other side is appealing from this decision. So I think we've got a procedural problem, assuming that there is a law of the case problem. And maybe we ought to have some additional briefing on that subject.
We do cite in footnote 9 the Native American Arts case, which indicates that this court certainly isn't bound on this appeal by any decision
we're not bound, but that's not the issue, it doesn't seem to me. It's a procedural issue.
Concerning the merits of the case, plaintiffs concede that they had reached age 63 when the city required them to retire in accordance with the city's mandatory retirement ordinance. Legislation that had been enacted 7.5 months earlier by the Chicago City Council. Yet plaintiffs contend that the city required them to retire without process. Significantly, plaintiffs have never identified any essential process under which they might have retained their jobs if such process had been made available to them. But, of course, the initial step in any due process analysis is whether the plaintiff had a property interest at all, so I'll address that issue first. Plaintiffs rely on Section 16.2B of the agreement, which specifies that employees shall be disciplined and discharged only for just cause. According to plaintiffs, that provision gave them a property interest against mandatory retirement because they assert mandatory retirement is a discharge without just cause. I think Judge Rosner properly explored the notion that mandatory retirement is not a discharge, and under 9.1C of the collective bargaining agreement, that provision makes clear that mandatory retirement and discharge are two different ways that contract, that the employment of a firefighter under that contract can be discharged, terminated. Before the different subsections in that section, it says the employment can be terminated and seniority rights can be dissolved in any of the following ways, and it lists six different ways.
Mr. Henriquez, forgive me, but let me be the devil. Section 9.1C does identify a variety of forms of termination other than discharges for just cause, but Article 9.1 concerns seniority. So how much weight can we give that provision, particularly on a motion to dismiss?
Well, it's only entitled seniority, but the provision says an employee's employment can be terminated in any of the following ways. And it lists six different ways that it can be terminated. The fact that seniority rights may terminate as well is a subsidiary concern. The provision clearly indicates and lists six different ways that the employment can be terminated, and one of the ways is discharge for cause, for just cause, and another of the ways is retires or is retired. Of course, the words is retired can only mean mandatory retirement, and so mandatory retirement is not a discharge, and because mandatory retirement is not a discharge, it's not subject to the just cause limitation. So their contention that the contract gives them a property interest because of the just cause limitation is incorrect. The just cause limitation simply does not apply. Alternatively, plaintiffs base their contention that they have a property interest against mandatory retirement on Section 13.1 of the agreement, which provides that in accordance with applicable law, neither the employer nor the union shall discriminate against any employee covered by this agreement because of any of a variety of characteristics, including age. But the initial clause of that provision, in accordance with applicable law, means that the agreement prohibits only discrimination that is prohibited by some anti-discrimination law. Yet plaintiffs have not identified any anti-discrimination law that the mandatory retirement ordinance violates. Even if plaintiffs had a property interest against mandatory retirement, the city did not deprive them of that interest without giving them all the process they were due. Specifically, if they had a property interest against mandatory retirement, they were deprived of that interest by the mandatory retirement ordinance itself. And that ordinance is an enactment applying across the board to a large category of city firefighters. And when such an across-the-board enactment deprives persons of a property interest, the legislative process by which the provision is enacted supplies all the process that is due. In other words, the normal Matthews v. Eldridge requirement of notice and an opportunity for hearing could either be considered not to apply at all, or if it is considered to apply, those requirements of notice and opportunity for hearing are satisfied by the process that the city council would go through, or any legislature would go through, in enacting the legislative measure. That's what happened here.
You know, the police officer CBA contained an express provision stating that nothing in its terms precluded mandatory retirement. Here, we don't have such a provision. So is the plaintiff's theory more tenable because of that?
Well, I think we do have an equivalent provision in this contract. Those same words, is retired in Section 9.1C, meaning mandatory retirement, was the contemplation that the city could thereafter enact a mandatory retirement ordinance. After all, the matter was in flux for many years, under federal law, which changed allowing mandatory retirement for certain periods, prohibiting mandatory retirement for certain periods, starting again to allow mandatory retirement. The matter was in flux when this contract was executed, and so the words is retired were a holding pattern. They indicated that the city and the union contemplated the reenactment of a mandatory retirement ordinance, so that when the mandatory retirement ordinance was thereafter reenacted, as the union and the city predicted that it might, that became applicable law, and for that reason it was allowed by the collective bargaining agreement. For these reasons, we request the court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Carnuth, you've got 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. The premature argument that they raised, that argument, as we indicated in our briefs, is without merit. They are a stop from raising that argument because they repudiated any rights that the plaintiffs had to go through any process at all by indicating that the mandatory retirement was not grievable. There's other reasons that we set out in our briefs, and we'll rely on our briefs for those bases. In terms of the property interest, that interest was established before the city passed its mandatory retirement law. At the time that the ordinance, collective bargaining agreement was ratified by the city and became an ordinance in January 1998, there existed no mandatory retirement law in Chicago. What did exist was the Chicago Human Rights Ordinance, which expressly prohibited age-based discrimination. That was the applicable law at the time. That law should have been adhered to by the city because in the CBA there's a provision under Article 19 saying that the city shall not pass any ordinance that diminishes the rights afforded plaintiffs under the collective bargaining agreement. And by passing the mandatory retirement ordinance and enforcing it against...
Excuse me, but doesn't that article actually refer to changes that would impair the binding effect of, isn't that the language, or make unenforceable the terms of the CBA? And in what way does that mandatory retirement ordinance impair the binding effect of or make unenforceable the terms of the CBA?
It impairs the provision of Section 13.1, which
requires... You mean the no discharge without just cause provision? Is that what you mean?
It impairs the no discharge without just cause because an arbitrary age is not a just cause for termination. And it also impairs Section 13.1, which is the non-discrimination provision, which precludes the city from discriminating based upon age.
But your theory then, let me get this straight, your theory then is that the CBA unambiguously prohibits mandatory retirement?
Correct.
But what if we believe that that language is ambiguous? Wouldn't Article 19 allow mandatory retirement so long as it's possible to reconcile the MRO with the ambiguous language of the CBA?
Well, there's no right to the city, as Your Honor pointed out, unlike the police officers agreement, which expressly allows mandatory retirement, this CBA does not provide for that. This contract is binding, does not provide for that. It has a provision saying no age-based discrimination is allowed, and it has this Article 19, which indicates that the city shall not pass any ordinance which would impair the binding terms of this agreement. Thank you, Your Honor. See, my time is up.
All right. This case be taken under advisement. Judge Cuddy has requested that there be supplemental briefing on the law of the case issue. So we'll go along with that, but we'd like to have it quickly. I don't know what a reasonable time is, but I don't know if you're going to have back and forth, but I think we'll have each of you submit something within 2 weeks on the law of the case issue.
Without any replies, Your Honor?
Pardon me?
Without a reply to each?
I think we could drag it out a while if we do that. So let's just each side give your opinion on the law, on the issue of law of the case, and then we'll take it from there.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks. This case will be taken under advisement along with the supplemental briefing.